This is Fresh Air, and I'm Terry Gross. My guest today is Fred Rogers, host of the Emmy Award-winning public television series Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. Rogers recently celebrated his 30th anniversary in children's television, and his program is the longest-running children's series on network TV.
It's a beautiful day in this neighborhood, a beautiful day for a neighbor. Would you be mine? Could you be mine?
Adults sometimes find the show remarkably low-key, but their children who watch get totally involved with Mr. Rogers as he talks and sings to them. For Rogers, children's TV is more than a job. It's a calling, one which he continued with even after he was ordained as a minister in the United Presbyterian Church.
So let's make the most of this beautiful day. Since we're together, we might as well say, would you be mine? Could you be mine? Won't you be my neighbor? Won't you please? Won't you please? Please, won't you be my neighbor?
I wanted to know what Fred Rogers was like as a child.
I was an only child. I had to make up a lot of my friends myself, and I think that was the beginning of the whole neighborhood of make-believe. I had a very rich fantasy life.
What were the friends that you had imagined?
I didn't imagine them. I had puppets. And so I would play with the puppets. And I can't remember their exact forms, but I knew that they were important to me. I think that all of the puppets in the neighborhood of make-believe are facets of who I am.
Was there somebody in your life who was the kind of figure for you, like you've become to so many children, who would, you know, like reassure you and, you know, want to discuss things with you? Of course, you can't actually step out of the TV and discuss it with all the kids, but you offer that to them. Was there someone like that for you?
I guess the closest person was my grandfather, Mr. McFeely. And, of course, we've named the Speedy Delivery Man for him. We called him Ding Dong because he taught us that childhood rhyme, Ding Dong Bell, Pussy in the Well. And everybody called him Ding Dong. He was the kind of person who would really support your strivings for autonomy. And while my parents and my grandmother were naturally very concerned about my health and hazards around, he was the kind of person who, when I would walk on one of his stone walls, for instance, and they would say, "Better get down." Ding Dong would say, "Ah, let the kid walk on the wall. He's got to learn to do things for himself." And that's so helpful to know that there are limits, but there are people who would help you to stretch beyond some of those limits.
What were the things that really scared you when you were a child?
I think the most scary thing was being alone and thinking that maybe nobody would come to get me. And I think that beginning school was tough for me. That's probably why I've done so much work for children in this area. I think also I was frightened of the doctor, and that's probably why I've made all those videotapes about helping children know about what hospitalization is like before they go. Probably why I wrote that song, I Like to Be Told, because I did. I liked to be told about things before I had to go do them.
Did you like scary movies or books?
I can't remember.
Did you go to the movies a lot?
I would go to the movies, and then I would come home and I would play the songs on the piano. I would pick out the songs on the piano that I heard at the movies. Yeah, it's hard for me to remember. I remember a couple movies that I liked, Shirley Temple. And I liked those kinds of stories that, she would always come out okay at the end. And I met Shirley Temple Black, not too long ago, and I just sat beside her in awe. And I said, it was interesting because the first thing I said to her was, you were one of my favorite people. She said, were. That was the first thing she said. And that really put me back. I expected her to say something about, I'm really glad that I could have been part of your childhood. But all she said was, were. I was one of your favorite people. Isn't that interesting?
Yeah, it is. Did she diminish in your esteem after saying that?
A little bit. But I think that so many people you put on pedestals when you see them from afar. And it's probably just not fair to expect them to be as wonderful as you thought they would be when you met them.
What about when you were a teenager? Was that an uncomfortable experience, or were you? Did you feel like you fit in with everybody in high school, which is, I think, a pretty traumatic time for a lot of people when they're growing up?
It sure is. I think that teenage years are probably uncomfortable for everybody. It's just that some seem to be able to carry it off with more elan than others. But it was tough for me at the beginning. And then I made a couple friends who found out that the core of me was okay. And one of them was the president or the head of the football team. He later became my best friend in high school. And we've carried on that friendship for a long, long time. As a matter of fact, his daughter's getting married next week in La Trobe, and we're all part of that wedding together. But that's a long, long time ago. We graduated in 1946. But it was after the beginning of that friendship that I was more accepted in school. Then I became the editor of the yearbook, and finally the president of the student council by the end of high school. But I was a very shy person going into high school.
What did you think you were going to be when you got out of school and started a professional career?
I thought I was going to be a diplomat, and was thinking about going to a school for diplomacy. And then I changed my mind, and this was during college. I wanted to be a minister and was all set to go to seminary after college. But I saw this thing called television, and I saw people throwing pies in each other's faces and all kinds of demeaning behavior. And I thought, I would really like to try my hand at that and see what I could do. And so instead of going to the seminary after graduation, I got a job at NBC in New York and went there for 2 years before joining educational television.
Well, you worked on the Hit Parade and the Kate Smith Hour, I think.
Mm-hmm, the Voice of Firestone and all of those programs.
What were the codes that you were taught then, you know, about what you can do and what you can't do on television?
Well, it was so young, Terry, that we were developing our own codes. Those production meetings were wonderful because everybody's ideas were entertained. And I enjoyed meeting the people that I worked with, and I felt good about those years, particularly the NBC Opera Theater. Working with those people was a magnificent experience. I'll never forget the time when we started A Mall and the Night Visitors. Menotti was commissioned by NBC to write that opera for television, and we did the first production of it. And Toscanini was still alive then, you know, he was the conductor of the NBC Symphony, and he came to the dress rehearsal. And when the rehearsal was over, he was in tears. And he went over to Giancarlo and hugged him and said, "This is the finest you've done so far, my son."
It surprises me, I think, that you left for a fledgling station, a brand new station in educational television, which was also new. It sounds like it was very risky to do that. Why did you make that switch?
I don't know. Pittsburgh was closer to where I grew up. Maybe I wanted to, I had just gotten married in New York, and maybe I had wanted to go back. I'm not sure that's so. I think that it had to do with wanting to work with children, because every day that I had off at NBC, I would go and visit a daycare center or an orphanage or a hospital that cared for children. And I cannot tell you why. I'm sure it had very deep roots. But when I got to Pittsburgh, and there were only three or four of us working at QED then, we weren't even on the air. This was in November of 53, and we didn't go on the air until April of 54, 30 years ago. One of the secretaries and I did a children's program together because nobody else wanted to do a children's program. But we were doing all of these other things as well. Each of us had a salary of $75 a week. And out of our own pockets, we bought all of the props for the program. And we called the program the Children's Corner. And it was on an hour every day. And I expected that I would play the organ for the hostess to sing. She would introduce all of the films, which I, as the producer, would get from all over the country. They had to be free because we didn't have any budget. Well, I didn't realize it, but those films were very brittle at times. And, of course, everything was live, and we'd be on the air, and here would be a film showing, and it would break. We'd have to fill with something. And so the night before we went on the air, Mrs. Dorothy Daniel, who was the general manager of the station, gave me a little tiger puppet. So I called him Daniel for her. And when the first film broke, I just poked the puppet through, and this was just a very fanciful set with drawings on it. And I just poked him through, and it happened to be a clock where I poked him through. And he just said,
"It's 5:02, and Columbus discovered America in 1492.
And that was the first thing that I ever said through puppetry on the air.
Wow.
But I just wanted you to know that necessity there was the mother of that invention, because it hadn't been planned. And so much that is spontaneous is what can be truly inspired. And I feel that all that I've done that's been really helpful and good has been inspired.
You went back to the seminary after doing children's programming for a while, right?
Well, I started with the station. And after we got that children's program going, it got to be so busy for us that the secretary and I both gave up all of our other duties to do the children's corner. As it got moving, the second year, I decided I would go to the seminary, so I went on my lunch hour and took courses just one at a time, never expecting that I would graduate. It took me 8 years. And I finally graduated and was ordained a minister in the Presbyterian Church.
Obviously, you're very religious, but I don't think you... it's not a denominational program, and I'm sure that's intentional on your part.
It's far from denominational and far from overtly religious. The last thing in the world that I would want to do would be something that's exclusive. I would hate to think that a child would feel excluded from the neighborhood by something that I said and did.
How did being a father change the way you did the program? Because you started the program before you had children.
Started the children's corner, yes, before I had children. But our children were 3 and 1 when we started the neighborhood. And, of course, that started in Canada. After I graduated from the seminary, I thought that I was going to do a program for the Presbyterian Church. And I was all set to do it on graduation. And the day before graduation, I found out that the money was not forthcoming to make the program. The day after graduation, I had a call from Dr. Frederick Rainsbury in Toronto, who was then head of children's programming for the CBC. He said, "Fred, I would like you to do a program for our network." I said, "You can't imagine what a voice from heaven you are to me right now," because I really didn't know what I was going to do. I could have accepted a parish ministry job, but I felt that this was a ministry in itself. So I went to Canada, took Joanne and the two boys, and we lived there for over a year. I did a daily program. I thought I was going to do puppets and music, as I had always done for those 8 previous years. But Fred said to me, "I have seen you talk with children, and I'd like you to translate that to the television screen." There are always a few people in this life who think that you can do more than you think you can do. And he was one of them. He trusted me so much that I began to think, well, maybe I can. And so we did.
Did it work right away?
Somehow it did. Oh. They were very sorry when I decided to come back to the United States. I decided that I wanted to raise the boys here.
I'm speaking with Fred Rogers, if you're just joining us. If you were proposing your show, Mr. Rogers, now to public television or to a commercial network, and it had never been on before, it hadn't had the history that it does, do you think that they would buy it and put it on?
I'm not sure. I think if I were the person making the choice, I certainly would put it on, because I know all that's behind the neighborhood. A lot of our philosophy doesn't show on the air, but it's there. I've worked with children and studied family life for many, many years, and I would hope that the programs that people would choose to put on the air would be ones that were really thoughtfully conceived and worked out.
Children's programs in the past few years have gotten so highly edited, where everything is really quick moving and lasts about 30 seconds or a minute. Has there ever been any pressure on you to do that kind of thing, the Sesame Street kind of thing, where there's just a lot of action and animation and scenery changes and all that real quickly?
No, there hasn't been pressure. I think it's simply because people have felt you shouldn't tamper with something that children seem to relate to. I do know that very early on, I was called to New York one time to possibly replace somebody who wasn't going to sign his contract at one of the networks. And the meeting was with the executives, who began by saying to me, "Now, what costume will you wear?" And I said, "Well, I would do just what I've always done." And they said, "Oh, well, you've got to have a costume, and maybe we should have a clown with you." And I said, "I really think I'm in the wrong office." And so there wasn't any more talk about that. But I think what's unique about our program is that I give myself. And most of the people on the program are just themselves. I've never considered myself an actor, Terry. And I think that children respond to that kind of honesty.
One of the things that you always do on your show is, you know, when you come in, you change into a cardigan and put on your sneakers. How did you develop that? It's become such a trademark of your program.
I think that it just came so naturally by my wanting to be comfortable myself that it's turned out that children seem to find that routine comfortable. I know many people have written to tell us that their children love to put on a sweater and sneakers when they hear the music of the neighborhood coming and sit down. And our program is one in which children seem to be able to be attentive to it for long periods of time. I've heard of very young children watching for a long time. In fact, some of our research shows some very interesting things, and that is that the younger the child, the more interested they are in the program when my face is on the screen. The older the child, they're more interested when there is the neighborhood of make-believe and the different puppets. But it leads me to believe that the younger children might consider the television screen as another mother's face. I think of the mother's face at feeding the infant as the map of the world. And if this is true, think how important what appears on the television screen is. You've seen people watching television and drinking a soft drink and eating popcorn and filling their mouths like a feeding experience. I'm sure you've seen that. I've seen it a lot. And I just wonder if that could be an analogy.
What do you think about television and children? A lot of parents don't want their kids to watch TV. And I know you're really sensitive about how media affects children. You do a TV show that's, I think, unlike any others. Do you think that television is necessarily good or necessarily bad for kids?
I think that a lot of it has to do with what the child is bringing to the television experience. That the drama within that child is going to determine how he or she will see a certain thing. So many people have talked about our work with such a simple thing as helping children understand that they can't go down the bathtub drain. And you know I sing that song, "You can never go down, can never go down, can never go down the drain." Well, if a child is very concerned about the loud rush of the flush of either the bathtub or the toilet and comes to the neighborhood on a day when I am talking about that, that will be highly dramatic for that child. That child will focus in on what I'm talking about and showing much more than if there were some very loud cartoon or all kinds of fancy production going on. And so it's the inner drama of the viewer and the listener that means so much in communication. You know, who's listening to us right now? What are their concerns? What are they worried about? What gives them joy? I'd love to know, because I think that radio and television and these things are very personal media. And the reason that I have worked all these years with children and with parents is that I want to know at least the general things that people are concerned about, so that I can speak to them and dramatize them as creatively as I know how.
Something that you really do is talk about what kids are scared of instead of just doing the clown bit, you know, having a clown is going to entertain them. Why do you focus on that? Because like a lot of your songs and sometimes on the show too, it's about what's making kids nervous. It's not an attempt to just like entertain them and make them laugh, you know?
I'd like them to know that there are things inside them that are okay to talk about, and they might feel anxious about them, and I feel that somebody needs to tell them that it's all right to talk about what they're scared of, what makes them angry, what makes them sad, what makes them happy. They should know that there is a full array of emotions in life, and all of them are fine. It's what we do with them that matters. And I like to think that the neighborhood is a kind of smorgasbord of ways to deal with how we feel. For me, it was always music and puppets. That's the way I dealt with how I felt. For others, it might be dance or welding or building with blocks. I could go on for a half an hour about all of the ways that we offer kids. We show them so many ways of healthy sublimation that I like to think that is a major part of what we do.
You're celebrating your 30th anniversary now with Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood.
Yes.
And it strikes me that many people now do what they're doing for like a year or 2 years, and then it's expected that you should progress, you should climb the ladder in whatever your profession is and go on. Do you feel like you've been going against the current?
Well, I think if you want to have a really deep relationship with somebody, you stay with it. And I have wanted through the years to have a really significant relationship with the young children who have used our work. And now, parents are writing to me to say, I grew up with the neighborhood, and now I'm giving it to my own children.
Can I just ask you one more thing before we go? You know how a lot of adults always say, God, I wish I was a child again. Do you ever wish you were 5 or 10 or 12?
Yes, but I'd like to be that with what I know now. And I think that I'd like that because there are a good many significant people in my life that I have lost through death, and I'd like to be able to talk with them again and tell them some things that I wasn't able to tell them then. In fact, I'd like to be able to tell them you are special.
Fred Rogers, host of the public television children's series Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood.